Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Dacia Eaton of KSKA, and by Skype, Dermot Cole of the Alaska Dispatch. Dacia, you recently did a story on the efforts to provide affordable housing here in Anchorage. Affordable housing is a concern, deep concern, to many in the community. What did you discover?
Well, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the state's housing agency, is about ready to build a 70-unit apartment complex over in Mountain View. It's going to be by the Glen Square Mall. It's about 6.5 acres, which is hard to find in the city, that's ready for development, and they're hoping to break ground on it this spring. What's unique about it is it's going to be mixed housing, which is a totally new direction for AHFC. So putting low-income housing in with more moderately priced housing and, you know, kind of mainstream middle-income housing. They want to get away from separating out people into public housing units and sort of creating housing, ghettos, if you will.
Is there a working definition of affordable?
Well, I think how I've looked at affordable in the stories that I've done is that it shouldn't be more than a third of your take-home pay. And for most working people, that's around minimum wage. So most of that housing, though, that for a one-bedroom apartment in Anchorage is over $1,000 a month. And that's usually more than a third of a working person's income. So it's a big issue. And obviously, we have this homelessness issue, number of people couch surfing, and all kinds of people in between housing and homelessness. The other big thing about this housing unit is that they've created a nonprofit subsidiary, AHFC has. And basically, that's going to allow them to get a whole bunch more tax credits. And the way they do that is by working in public-private partnerships. So there'll be a lot of private money also poured into these developments. And they're going to do a bunch of these down the road. And they're hoping to not only have it be mixed housing, like you see in many larger cities like Seattle, for instance, but also to have retail on the ground floor. So to make it more of a village feeling.
Okay, that's great. Steve, Assemblyman Chris Birch wants to move the Anchorage municipal election from the spring to the fall. Why, and what are the obstacles he is facing?
He's facing quite a few obstacles. First of all, he's looking at the voter turnout from the last 10 elections or so, and he's got a point. The turnout's been pretty low, between 15% maybe and 30% on some mayoral elections. Most of the time, it's in the low 20% turnout. So this is something that he's. I can't exactly remember the exact year that we did this, but we used to have municipal elections in October, and they were moved to April for the same reason, because they were getting lost, critics said, in the primary in August, and then the statewide general election in November.
And we should note that most of the rest of the state of Alaska does have their elections, municipal elections, in October.
In October, that's correct. So we moved ours to April, and it really hasn't helped voter turnout. But voter turnout has been going down across the country, and it's in big cities as well. This is not just a phenomenon true to Anchorage. Now, Birch has gone in, and he's made this proposal. The big problem that he's having is the questions about the motives. There is the labor ordinance that the mayor pushed through earlier this year, and there's a lot of the critics feel that Chris Birch and some of the mayor's supporters in this effort to take away some of the power of the unions, they want to push this back to at least November or even further down the road to have a referendum that number of supporters to roll back these.
And there are legal questions too about his salary, right?
Yeah, well, that's
and
another
the other
one. Yeah,
is, yeah,
yeah. I think if you get. They will get another $20,000 if they push this election back. They get $28,000 a year. Birch and several other assembly members are supposed to be termed out in April. They have served three-year terms. If they push the election, the April election, back to November, they'll earn approximately another $20,000. So a lot of people say there's a conflict of interest, including the city's ethics board that says there is a conflict of interest if the assembly votes on this. Now, Chris Birch says, okay, fine, the ethics board does a good job, but I just don't want it to let it lay there. I'm just still going to introduce this. You've got people like Midtown Assemblyman Dick Traney saying, if he introduces this, I'm walking out. I'm not going to commit a breach of ethics because Chris Birch is asking me to do this. So so you've got two things there. You've got the possible conflict of interest.
Is he building any kind of coalition to get votes that will produce this change?
Again, if you go back to this labor ordinance where the mayor's proposal was approved by the assembly to lessen the power, the negotiating power of city labor unions. If you go back to that, there is a core of assembly people who approved this. The thought is if this is pushed back into November, where more people will turn out in a November election, that would maybe balance the outpouring of voters who might come out in a smaller turnout, who favor rolling this ordinance back. You could see the unions in their power last April in the assembly election.
So it's going to get caught up in this whole other issue of the municipal contracts, is what it sounds
like. Yeah, that's what some people are alleging here. Okay. They're saying that that's.
Let's get Dermot Cole in here. Dermot, Alaska faces a $2 billion budget shortfall. Usually the deficit is blamed on one, falling production, oil production, which produces our tax revenue, most of it, or two, the price of oil itself. But you have a different perspective. Explain.
Well, Mike, like all other aspects of oil taxes, it's complicated, and we're going to discuss that in a little bit here. The $2 billion deficit, which legislators and the governor did not see coming 6 months ago, 6 and 9 months ago, is the result of several things happening basically at the same time. And isolating each particular factor has become quite a substantial political exercise. It's dropping prices. Oil prices are somewhat lower than expected, not a great deal lower. Production is somewhat lower, not a great deal lower than expected. But cost of production, producing and developing oil on the North Slope are increasing and are expected to continue to increase. Those factors, along with the new oil tax bill, Senate Bill 21, have led to, created this circumstance where the deficit is much larger than it was expected for this current fiscal year. Now, that fiscal year runs until next summer. This week, the governor announced his budget for the fiscal year that begins next July. And that shows a sharply reduced level of general fund spending. And this is largely triggered by the change in the oil revenue forecast.
Okay, and again, these are not tax credits. These are the costs of their investment, right? The company's investments.
Correct.
Okay, now couldn't Governor Parnell say that proves that my theory is working, that if we give people the opportunity to invest, set the right atmosphere, they will invest?
That's true, but one of the side effects of that is to push down the tax rate. So greater investment on the North Slope is going to mean lower tax rates and reduced income for the state of Alaska. This next legislative session starts in January, is going to be all about arguments over revenue and whether or not the new tax bill is to blame or whether or not it is simply a matter of prices and production. In fact, there are several things going on here, and the new tax law is one of the reasons why income is down. It's not just simply a reduction of price. It's quite remarkable, though, Mike, if you think about it. We've got oil prices over $100, and that's regarded as a low oil price now. And it wasn't that long ago when, prices half of that level would be considered sky high.
And there was a time in our lifetime when it was $9.
That's true. I mean, during the Murkowski administration a decade ago, it was a much different scenario. But we are in a difficult position now. The state needs high oil prices to survive. The new definition of what is high is, becomes over $100. And production is continuing to decline.
We're going to have to move on here. Thank you very much, Dermot. Steve, for the first time, researchers have looked at the history of Anchorage police shootings, Anchorage Police Department shootings.
Right.
What did they find, and what did Police Chief Mark Mew have to say in response to the study?
Yeah, this is a study that the UAA Justice Center did. It went back about 20 years, studied 45 different shootings that occurred during that time. It doesn't really show why the shootings happen, but it does kind of explain some of the circumstances that were involved. One of the findings was that officers have never fired, at least in this 20-year period, they had never fired on an unarmed person, a person who was either carrying a gun or using their vehicle as a weapon. We've seen a number of instances where police officers were almost run over by people that they're trying to arrest.
40% in this study.
I think it was 40%, that's right. 40% of the people using their vehicle as a weapon against against police officers. They also showed that that officers, some of the characteristics, they never fired more than three shots, I think, or there's always three shots or fewer shots involved. The majority of the shootings happened north of the Tudor Road area. One of the breakdowns that they did, they said the vast majority of shootings involved white males, but there was a disproportionate amount of African Americans and Pacific Islanders
compared to their actual population.
Yeah. That were involved in shootings as well. There's not enough statistical information here, not enough information according to the Justice Center to establish any kind of a trend. Over the last 2 years, however, this year and in 2012, there have been five shootings each. And that's a lot. That's a high number for this town. But for the most part, the average has been around about two shootings, and they say that's pretty normal. And they, in fact, describe it as a rare incident here in the Anchorage area for police shootings. They basically scratched the surface with this, I think, and they want to know things. For instance, one of the questions that Mark Mew wanted to know, Chief Mew, how many times did an officer feel that maybe he should use his gun but didn't, and what were the circumstances involving it? What did the officer do to avoid using his weapon in a particular instance? He thinks that there may be a high instance of that, where an officer was justified in using armed, his weapon, but did not.
And that'll be the next study.
Right.
Disha, let's get you in here. You've been following this story.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out a couple of things that were interesting to me. They didn't fire ever on someone who was unarmed, but they did count simulated weapons, knives, and one blunt object, that blunt object being in the case of Shane Tosse.
Yeah, the broomstick handle. Yeah.
So out of those 45, there were six that weren't guns or vehicles, basically. And I think that's good to note. I also found it really interesting that in the first 10 years of the study, African Americans were disproportionately affected. They were involved in more of these situations. And then in the last 10 years, that number was virtually replaced by Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders. And I think there are some real questions there. Obviously, the Pacific Islander population in Anchorage has grown by about, I think, 2%, they said, during that time period. Yeah. So that has something to do with it, but they're still disproportionately affected. And I think there are some real questions that maybe a social scientist could ask about that situation.
Now, Desha, what percentage, or if we know the exact percentage, roughly, of these people who were shot and died had criminal records?
I was just looking at that. it was almost 70% had at least one conviction for a crime prior to the incident. And of course, the police sort of use this to say, well, you know, these people had committed crimes before. But it's interesting to ask, is there kind of a class issue? Is this a certain class of people who are involved in the criminal justice system? I think that's a good question to ask. And you know, when they get pulled over, are they more likely to react or try to run away? I don't know what the situation is.
And some of these people had outstanding warrants, we can be sure of that.
Some people did. But one thing that Mark Mew said to me is that, you know, in the old days, 20 years ago, more often there was a very serious crime going on when a shooting occurred. and it was a very dangerous person. But nowadays, you pull somebody over, you think it's a traffic violation, traffic stop, and it escalates very quickly into these situations that we saw here.
And you have to wonder how that impacts police officers as well, when they know that this trend is occurring out there, where people are more prone to use a weapon during a routine traffic stop or whatever. It's got to put a police officer on edge, much more so than perhaps, as you mentioned, 20 years ago.
Pretty stressful.
Okay, yeah. Let's go back to Dermot Cole in Fairbanks. Dermot, Governor Sean Parnell said his oil tax regime is based on simplicity. But you have looked at the legislation, and from your perspective, there is nothing simple about the Parnell approach. Explain.
Well, Mike, this is basically because I'm a simple person. It's very difficult for me to understand this. I've spent a lot of time trying to unravel it. One of the political themes is to say over and over again that it's simple and that the solutions are simple. In fact, the law is complicated. The whole situation is very, very interrelated with many other economic and political factors. And you're dealing with some of the world's largest corporations. So it is not simple, and that's really a sort of a line that ought to be dropped. Because
can you give us an example of complexity?
Well, for instance, just recently in the regulations released by the Department of Revenue, it describes how oil is going to be classified as new oil or old oil. New oil, which is going to be developed in areas that are not in existing units, is going to be taxed at a lower rate. And the oil companies will have a great incentive to find new oil as opposed to old oil. In the regulations, they just came out and said, if oil cannot be drained from an old area to a new area, unless it is more efficient to develop it from the new area. Now, that just leads to a sort of big open field for engineers, accountants, and lawyers to argue that point. But the whole situation is rife with complexity, including, maybe as we said before, the interrelationship of price, production, the oil tax cut, and the cost of development. According to one analysis that I've looked at, in 2015, the tax per taxable barrel on the North Slope will be close to what it was during the ELF era. That's a remarkable change.
Okay. Daisha, the state rejects the recall petition that directed at Anchorage Representative Lindsay Holmes after she changed parties from Democrat to Republican. Why?
Basically, they said they were not compelled by the legal reasoning of the people who filed the recall.
Their grounds were insufficient.
Their grounds, which they said were lack of fitness for office, and they argued that Holmes had violated a compact with voters when she changed her party affiliation to Republican not long after her election. But they said, man, that doesn't work for us. But the recall group says they plan to file an appeal, and it is interesting to note that there's never been a successful recall of an Alaska legislator.
Well, there are a couple things that are quite noticeable about this. One is they can file an appeal, but it'll be difficult to overcome the state's objections on the question of fitness for office. And second, they had a lot of trouble getting this first round of signatures to present to the state of Alaska, and it took them a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's quite clear that they would even have a tougher time getting many times that number of signatures to get a recall on the ballot. Steve, you want to add something?
Maybe a state legislator or a governor, certainly, or a mayor, they've never been recalled in the state of Alaska. We have had three school board members recalled several years ago. You might remember that when they had the coup on TV one night before the school board, and they tossed out the fellow who was the head of the school board at that time. There are three or four of the school board members who were behind that were recalled and thrown out of office. Carol Stolpe was one of them, and
that's right.
And a couple of others who also went on. I think this is one of those deals that perhaps the people who want to recall Lindsay Holmes, they'll put up their own candidate. That's probably what they're going to wind up doing, putting up their own candidate and then being highly motivated to get out and vote for that particular candidate.
And I'm told
well.
That's a competitive district for the Democrats. They would have a chance.
Yeah, they would. It's a big-time Republican district. It really is. It went heavily for Mitt Romney in the presidential election. But, yeah, you had, with Lindsey Holmes and then you had Hollis French, you had two Democrats in that area elected to office. That's kind of rare in Anchorage. So, it is a friendly place to Democrats.
Okay, Steve, the extension of Elmore Road further into the UMed district has been taken as a given here in recent years as it's moved forward. But there are many, many details to be heard and to be known. And suddenly there is one detail. It may cost a lot more than the proponents thought.
Yeah. This is an issue that's been going on since Michael was a kid. So it's been like 80 years since they've been talking about this, right?
I talked to Warren Harding about it.
It's been going on a long time that they've been wanting to push this road through to connect this side of the UMed district with East Northern Lights. And I just think this was before even we had an Elmore Road, I think, as a matter of fact.
Or at least it had that name.
Yeah, before it had that name. That's correct. So they've been wanting to do this. The UMed district, if you've been over here, in fact, we're sitting in the UMed district right now, very crowded place. It's growing faster than any sector of the city, I think. More jobs, thousands of people work here. So it's hard to get in, hard to get out. And so one of the ways of helping traffic move a little bit better, more freely, is to push a road through from Elmore Road.
And I'm going to have to level with the viewers here. If that road goes through, Steve McDonald and Daisha and I will be looking at it when we do this.
Yeah. In fact,
one
of the lanes, Daisha will be in the middle of one of the lanes. Yeah. So we're going to move out of there right, if it goes through right
but
now.
But we digress, Steve. Go right ahead.
Well, that's right. There's four proposals. Two of them involve four lanes. Two of them involve two lanes. And the four lanes, which everybody seems to really like, all of a sudden came back as like a $42 million project. Problem is they got $20 million, so they're short. And this kind of slipped out during a talk one of the developers was giving, and the developer is now saying, well, you know, that's not a hard and firm dollar figure, but it's out there now, and it gives people an idea of just how expensive this project could be. So now it may be overpriced. Maybe they may have to settle on a smaller, maybe the two lanes, or maybe they have to scale back on some of the amenities.
And part of the trickiness here is that we're heading into a difficult financial time at the state level, and federal government's already got their problems with funding.
Senator Kevin Meyer says, don't expect any more money from the state on this, at least not right now. There just isn't money in the capital budget to help this project along. So they say they may have to do something on the short term, maybe go two lanes, and then later on down the road, so to speak, go to four
lanes. Daisha, briefly, dare I say it. Yeah. Tennis courts. Yeah. Tennis courts versus ice rinks. Tennis courts.
The story that keeps on giving,
yes.
Michael. So it's been 2 months of back and forth between the assembly and the mayor's office and a bunch of people who are very involved in tennis in the community about whether or not we should have this recreation center, called the Northern Lights Recreation Center, which would be largely comprised of indoor tennis courts. How far back should I go? So there's a bunch of money.
Okay, let's try this. What is the future of this app to be? Are we really going to have a vote on this?
Well, what happened at last Tuesday's assembly meeting was this money for these tennis courts was rolled into project monies that came, Project 80s, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
That came from the legislature, and the assembly never asked for it, and they were kind of like, where'd this money come from? Yeah. Why do we have it? And then the mayor said, oh yeah, I've been talking to a bunch of tennis folks here about, you know, getting this recreation center, and it'll be so great, and we can have public tennis courts where, you know, young people can come in and not have to pay a lot of money to play tennis, which sounds like a great idea. And then it just became a big fight, kind of between people who wanted the money just to go to infrastructure projects that it was originally meant for, and for hockey rinks in particular, Sullivan Arena. And then the assembly voted it down at last Tuesday's assembly meeting. It took me a long time to get to that.
Let's go to Steve here. 30 seconds, Steve. How did we get so sideways on this political
issue? It is. You talk to any assembly member and they're all going, what happened with this whole thing? It is. It's one of those crazy things that just blew up. But where it's going to go, I don't know. Some assembly members say, okay, we'll just do the $4 million and we'll get some bonds later on and finish it off. Or they want to buy the tennis courts over on the north side that belong to the Alaska Club right now.
Now Mayor Sullivan has made a new proposal to bring down the price to $7.2 million.
Yeah.
And he's going to try to make a case for that.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it right there with the knowledge that we undoubtedly will get back to it. Dermot, militiaman Schaefer Cox of Fairbanks, now serving time in a federal prison, is asking Amnesty International for help, and he's also cast some light on his mental illness plea. Please explain.
Well, Mr. Cox was convicted and then sentenced in early 2013 to 26 years in prison for conspiracy to commit murder and for a variety of weapons charges. He has a public defender in Seattle who plans to appeal this case to the Ninth Circuit. But in the meantime, letters from Mr. Cox have been posted on Facebook pages by people supporting him. And he says that when he said he was sorry and apologized at his sentencing, he really didn't mean it, that he only did it because his attorney had told him if he did that, there's a chance he wouldn't get a life sentence. So he said he did it for a reduced sentence. He also said he would agree to, you know, a medical examination, which said he had a mental illness. So now he's saying that none of that was true. It seems to be the action of somebody who's really not, an attorney would tell him not to have.
We got to leave it right there. I'll be back next week, and so will Alaska Edition. Good night.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.